Thank you, Chris. And it's always a pleasure to be able to come to the Seminole Church. I've been blessed to do that from time to time through the years, starting with the old building back in town, and now then being able to come here. It's just always enjoyable to get to visit with you all again. And yes, I've known Connie a long time, and I've just always had such high admiration for her and respect for her. And I knew her so well as a student, and then found out she was going to get married to some guy in the Coast Guard that none of us on campus knew. Well, you know, teachers that care about their students kind of want to know who this person is and what the story is. And, of course, it didn't take long after meeting Chris to find out that Connie was just as capable and just as responsible in selecting a husband as she was in everything else that she did. And so both of them have been really, really dear friends for a long time. And it's just, it's really a pleasure to have good friends in different places. A number of years ago, I knew a young woman. She was at the time a senior in high school. And I'm just going to call her Shirley. Shirley had grown up in a congregation in this particular area and had really been kind of like teenagers sometimes are, the apple of the eye of the church. The church had loved and admired her. She had grown up in a Christian family. She had been faithful all of her life. She had just been one of those young ladies that you're proud of and you're glad to say she's one of ours. She got about a third of the way into her senior year in high school and something happened. I don't think I know to this day what happened. But she went crazy and began living a grossly immoral lifestyle. And her friends went to her and tried to persuade her to quit, and various people would try to talk to her, and her parents tried to talk to her, and nothing really worked. And you know how those things sometimes go. After a while, she decided that people were just criticizing her and condemning her, and nobody cared about her. And she told me on one occasion, she said, "I feel like when I walk into church, I feel like that everybody thinks that there's just a big sign over me that says, 'Sinner.'" And she said, "I just don't know whether I can stand going to church anymore. I just can't stand that attitude." And of course, it reminds us a little bit of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Their own sins did not give them brightness of thought, didn't give them clarity of perception. It gave them a defensiveness about what they were doing. And so it did for Shirley. Time went on, and finally people, just about everybody had talked to her that could, and still no change in her life. And she got to the point as the spring came on that she would come to church part of the time and part of the time she wouldn't. She had dropped out of the youth group, didn't have much to do with it. And to say that it was a great heartache to everybody in that church would be an understatement. Well, she sat in my professional office. I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist and counselor. She sat in my professional office one Monday morning in the spring. And she announced to me that she had decided this past weekend that that would be the last time she would ever, ever go to church. She said, "Everybody just thinks I'm awful anyway. Everybody just thinks I'm terrible." And she said, "There just wasn't going to be any reason to keep on going back there with everybody thinking that I was just the worst person in town." And I doubt that people thought that. People were concerned and people loved her and cared about her. Tried to talk to her, and probably some of them did a better job than others. But she began to tell me that morning in my office what had happened at church the night before, Sunday night before. She said, "Because it was going to be the last time that I'd ever go to church, I decided that I didn't really want to talk to anybody, and probably nobody wanted to talk to me. And so," she said, "I planned to get there late so that I could just go in, sit down on the back row, and during the last song, just get up and leave, and that would be it for me." Well, it so happened when she came in late that night that one of the elders of that church, a man that I knew quite well, and on one occasion had told me, he said, He said, Lynn, he said, you may wonder why I stand back in the church lobby during much of the service a lot of times. He said, the reason I do that is, he said, the way I look at it is that people who get to church late, no telling what they had to go through just to get there. And he said, if they're coming in late, I figure they need somebody to make them feel welcome. I figure they need somebody to make them feel that it's okay to come in late. So he said, I like to stand back there and try to encourage people and welcome them when they come in. Well, he was back there in the church lobby that Sunday night when Shirley came in. He knew the story, of course, and knew all about it. He was a very loving, caring man, he and his wife both. And so when she came in, he went over and put his arm around her and he said, Shirley, I am so glad you're here tonight. He said, now we're kind of full in there. And he said, there aren't many seats, but he said, my wife is sitting near the back and she's saving a place for me. Why don't you sit with us? Had his arm around her, and she couldn't really refuse that. She had known him all of her life, and so she agreed, and she went in, and they sat down near the back and sat there through the service. And she's telling me this story on Monday morning. She said, sure enough, during the last song, she said, I got up and left, and she said, I don't remember much about that service. Don't really remember what the preacher preached on. I don't remember much about the songs or anything else. She said, what I do remember is Sister So-and-so sitting there with her arm around my shoulder, hugging me and patting me through the service. She said, I could feel her love. I could feel her acceptance. I could feel that she really cared about me. And I could tell that her husband did too, because he had been so friendly and so welcoming. And that's when she told me, she said, I had decided that last night would be the last time I'd ever go to church. I just couldn't take it anymore. But she said, after sitting with them and after feeling their love, she said, I think maybe I will try just a little bit more. And so she made an appointment to see me for counseling the next morning. And as we talked about that and over a period of time worked through the issues that were involved in her lifestyle, and it took quite some time, but eventually Shirley did repent. She did come back to the Lord. She did do what was right. And a few years later, she met a good Christian young man. They got married. They moved to another part of the country where the church is very weak. And in fact, there was just one little congregation near them that was just barely hanging on. And she later told me how that when they got there and they had a couple of children by that time, they thought that maybe this church would be glad to have a young family with a couple of children there, because there really weren't any in the church. And she said almost nobody would speak to them. And wouldn't have a whole lot to do with them. She said we'd attended there for a number of weeks and nobody invited us to lunch. She wasn't really complaining. But this is now then some years after the thing had happened in high school. And she said, so I just decided that if they wouldn't have me for lunch, I'd have them for lunch. So she systematically had every member of that church for lunch. I think there were about 30 of them. She had every member in that church to her home for lunch over the next some weeks. And they became the spark plug to help that little church kind of revive a little bit. I'm not going to tell you that that church turned into a mega church or anything like that, but it kind of helped to bring some warmth and some love to that church, because she knew what it was to feel love and acceptance from somebody at a desperate time in her life. And that's what she felt here. And I've been so blessed through the years to know her and to know that here was a young lady whose life, whose soul was saved because there were a couple of people who hadn't given up on her. There probably were some others too, but they had a special opportunity to show love and acceptance and to kind of bridge the gap of judgment that she had felt so strongly. And as I thought about that story and thought about her experience, it seems to me that there are some lessons that we can learn from Scripture as to how to be good family members ourselves. whether it's the family that we have with our own children and our husbands and wives and grandchildren, or whether it is the church as our family. And our role model, as we all know, always is the Lord Himself. There was a time in which Jesus was talking about the permanence of relationship in the family. In John chapter 8, beginning in verse 31, Jesus said to the Jews who had believed Him, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered Him, "We're Abraham's descendants, and we've never been slaves of anyone. How can you say, therefore, that we shall be set free?" Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever." A son belongs to it forever. A daughter belongs to it forever. There are times in which that son or that daughter may be wayward. There are times in which that son or that daughter may be a disappointment and even a heartbreak. But it's still our child, and it's still a part of our family. And Jesus says that once a person is adopted into God's family, they become a son, a daughter, forever. Reading that passage has made me want, through the years, to do an intensive study. I've never quite gotten around to it, to do an intensive study of the word forever in Scripture. Because it is a powerful term about a lasting relationship that God has created that extends beyond, of course, this world itself. And so for the next few minutes, I want to talk to you about three qualities that we see in God Himself that we can adopt from God in our own lives as family members, in our own lives as members of the family of God. And the first of those is that God has an unbroken commitment to His family. Now, He had lots of reasons to break that commitment. He had lots of reasons to give up on the world. What we see whenever the flood came around in Genesis chapter 6 is a statement that God was sorry that He ever created man. But that sorrow did not cause Him to obliterate the human race. There still is the hope and the possibility of grace and the possibility of forgiveness that we see in the saving of Noah and his wife and his sons and his daughters-in-law, 8 people. In 1 Chronicles chapter 16, the writer talks about God's commitment to His promises. Verse 15, "He remembers His covenant forever, the word He commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant He made with Abraham, the oath He swore to Isaac. He confirmed it to Jacob as a decree, to Israel as an everlasting covenant." I know that at times whenever we study covenants, we say, well, a covenant is a contract. And indeed it is. But a covenant in the Bible is far more than a contract. It is an effort on the part of the eternal God to establish and create a relationship with whoever the people are with whom He's making a covenant. And the covenants that He makes in the Old Testament are covenants that are designed to bring the people of Israel into a personal relationship with Him forever. The history of the Israelite people through the Old Testament is a story of unfaithfulness. I've never taken the time to count up how many times the people of Israel fell away into idolatry. And idolatry and adultery are essentially the same. They are the giving of one's heart, the giving of one's affection, the giving of one's most intimate being to somebody else, and breaking the heart of the one to whom one is first committed in the process. And time again in the Old Testament, we see God's heart broken. We often see His anger. And so some people would say, well, the God of the Old Testament is an angry God, but I suggest to you that the God of the Old Testament is a wounded and a heartbroken God who loved His people, who tried desperately to create a relationship with them. And sometimes the relationship worked, but sometimes it didn't work. But though they often gave up on him, he never gave up on them. The first quality that I see of a loving family member is to have an unbroken sense of commitment to our family. An unbroken sense of commitment to our family as the church. But a second quality that I see in the Lord Himself that I want to adopt is that He has undying love for His family. No matter what we do, His love does not go away. And for that, I'd like for you to turn to Luke chapter 15, that familiar story of the prodigal son. That story that has so many different dimensions to it and so many angles that we could talk about. The mother is not mentioned in this story, but I'm going to assume her presence. And you know the story, how that this son comes to his parents and says, whatever the inheritance is that I'm supposed to get one of these days, I'd like to get it now. Now, folks, that was no more a part of their custom than it is part of our custom. You just don't go to your living parents and say, give me whatever it is you plan to give me one of these days because I want to go do whatever I want to do. And so the fact that his parents actually give him the inheritance is in and of itself pretty astonishing. And you know, if you were to give part your inheritance to your children, let's say you have two kids, and let's say that you divide it 50-50, and let's say that your house is worth $100,000 and your car is worth $10,000 just for easy numbers, and let's say you've got $50,000 in the bank, $160,000 and maybe another $10,000 in assets of some sort, $170,000. Well, let's add another $10,000 in there somewhere so the math is easy for the speaker. $180,000. Could you all of a sudden just write a check for $90,000 to one of those kids? Well, of course not. Because, as we say, your wealth is tied up in assets. It's in a car, it's in a house, it's in the stock markets, it's in savings. And so for these parents to give to this child his portion of the inheritance, they had to downsize in a major way. It doesn't describe that, but common sense says they had to. On top of being heartbroken that their son would think so little of them as to treat them that way. But they give him the money. Now we know what he does with it. He goes away into another country. He spends it on drugs and alcohol and sex and gambling and whatever all else he does, and finally comes to the end of his rope and is starving to death and is out there in the pigsty about to die. And here we see one of the great spiritual principles of life, and that is, when you put God's Word deep into the heart of a person, at some point, regardless of what that person goes through, at some point that good teaching more than likely is going to rise to the surface, and it does in him. And what he says is, my Father's hands, His servants, have it better than I do, and I'm going to rise and go back home to my Father and say, Dad, I'm not worthy to be called your son anymore. I've treated you badly. I've squandered what you've given me. Would you just give me a job? Because he said he knew that his dad was a good man. And so he got up and he went home, and I can only halfway imagine how hard it must have been for him to prepare his way going back home. How he had to practice that speech and kind of work himself up into it and to anticipate, what am I going to do if I say that to my dad and my dad says, oh, did you learn something over there, smarty pants? What'd you learn over there? Did you have a pretty good life? His dad, of course, didn't do that. There's nothing smart here. There's only compassion. There's only concern. There's no judgment. On the other side of matters, we can think about the father and the mother. In verse 20 it says, so he got up and went to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. Now that says to me, Mom and Dad have been spending a lot of hours sitting out on the front porch of that new little house that they're living in, hoping and praying one day maybe he'll come back. We don't know how many prayers they've prayed. We don't know how many years have passed. We don't know how many tears they've cried. We don't know how many heartbreak they've suffered. We don't know how many nights they've stayed awake, but we know it's a lot. And Dad sees him coming home, and he's filled with compassion. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And you know the rest of the story, how they throw a big party and they're happy to have him home, and everything is wonderful because the son that I thought was surely dead, any way and every way you want to take that word, is alive. And he's come home. And one of the many great messages of this passage in Luke 15 is that when God is your Father, you can always go home. You can always go home. And it ought to be one of the great messages that settles into our hearts with our own families. Whether it's with the Shirleys that might come back, that need to come back, that need to feel our love and to know if you come back here, you will only experience compassion and love and acceptance. You won't get judgment. That's between you and God. The fact that you've come back is the most wonderful thing that could have ever happened. And what we see in God here, as He is the Father in this story, is His undying love for His family. Heartbroken and dishonored as he was, yet he loved them. The final quality that we see of God in his dealings with his family is his unlimited forgiveness. You and I all know the story about Peter asking Jesus, "How many times should I forgive my brother?" I mean, that story in Matthew 18, that whole chapter is about forgiveness and dealing with sin and those who offend us and all that sort of thing. And Peter got the message that if you're a follower of Jesus, you're not stingy with your forgiveness. You are profuse with your forgiveness. But now that's the Bible teaching as we're sitting here on Wednesday night and nothing much is offending us directly at the moment. But it's a whole big different story whenever somebody seriously sins against you and it costs you a lot of money. It costs you a lot of embarrassment and humiliation among your friends. It might even create legal problems, all kinds of other problems for you and for whoever else it is. And then you forgive them and say, "Okay, we're going to put this behind us and go on," and bang, it happens again, or something similar happens again. And the second time we try, but it's harder because when you've been hurt once, you're not eager to stick your finger back into that wall socket where there's electricity. Every time it hurts, we are more reluctant to get close to whatever it was that hurt us, and it is human nature to draw back and to put distance so that whatever it is that has hurt us can't hurt us anymore. And yet Peter understood, "Am I supposed to forgive my brother 7 times 7? Well, that's a bunch of times. And the Lord says something like, "Well, really, 70 times 70, which really is a way of saying, "You know, Peter, there's not any limit to forgiveness." Now, you and I really like that teaching because it means that however many years we've lived and however many sins we've committed and however many times we promise to God we won't do the very thing we have done again and again and again and again, that we know that God will still forgive us. And we love this teaching. And rightfully we should. But the point of the teaching and the point of the passage as he goes on to tell the story of the unmerciful servant is, as you have been forgiven, so you are to forgive. You know the parable of the unmerciful servant that owes some money the master calls in the debts. It's finally time. We've just extended you and extended you and extended you, and it's finally time to pay. "I can't pay." Then sell the man's property, put his kids in bondage, make them work for me, sell his wife, and put him in prison until the debt's paid. Well, that basically means the end of his life and the destruction of his family, and life is over for him. And you can just see the guy falling, begging for mercy, and just destroyed it at this decree. And yet, at the same time, from a legal standpoint, it's what he agreed to when he borrowed the money. The master is touched with compassion and forgives him. And he goes down the hallway, runs into one of his fellow servants that owes him $5 and hadn't paid it back. And he starts beating him up because he won't pay him $5. Another worker oversees all this, goes back and tells the master, "The guy that you forgave everything is now then being so petty as to beat up on another guy over a little old measly $5. And he's called back in, and then he does have to pay the price. The message, of course, is it is so wonderful to know that we have a loving Father that forgives us in an unlimited fashion. But the expectation from Him is that we will do the same, or else we will pay. And that's the part we don't like. But the great message here is that God is a God of unlimited forgiveness. No matter what you've done, no matter how many times you've done it, no matter how many times we promised we wouldn't do it again and we did it again, God will forgive us. And there's a point there at which we start questioning ourselves and say, well, I know God promises this and I believe His promise, but it's hard for me to accept the fact that apparently I willfully sinned many times when I promised God I wouldn't, and so how can I really be forgiven? You've had that thought too. I obviously don't know the inner thoughts or the inner life of any other human being in this world, but I think I know just enough about human nature to know we've all been there and had that thought. The God that we live for, the God who loves us and why He loves us the way He does, I don't understand. Now, one day in eternity, I will understand that. We'll comprehend it. At this point, we know it to be true, but we cannot comprehend how and why the great Creator of this universe, the one and only God of all, loves us, is compassionate to us, is forgiving of us, and let His Son die to save us. We know it's all true, but we can't comprehend it. And so it is this God who does not break His commitment. He has an unbroken commitment to us, and I'm thankful for that, because if it depended upon my commitment, it would be at risk. The relationship would be. He is a God of undying love who loves me despite the fact that I am not lovable, despite the fact that I am a disappointment. I mean, just because I cleaned up and put on a jacket tonight doesn't mean that what God sees is very different from what you see. His love is undying and His forgiveness is unlimited. He is a God that we should imitate in every way. He gives us these great qualities to imitate in our lives, in our own families. The same qualities that we should imitate in our life, in this family, the church. And there are a lot of people out there. There are a lot of people out there that need to feel this kind of commitment from us to them. That need to feel this kind of love from us to them. And that need to feel this kind of forgiveness and acceptance from us to them. We need to figure out how to make it as easy as it can humanly possibly be for people to come back and to fit in and to feel a part of the family. The same thing you would want for your daughter or your son if they had left and lived a profligate life, and then had waked up and decided they'd come back, but they didn't know whether it was okay to come back or not. And for any mother or father in here, if we found out that a son or a daughter or a granddaughter or a niece or a nephew or a cousin or a kissing cousin, whatever that is, my grandmother explained it to me, but I never got it straight, whoever it might be, were to let us know in the middle of the night that they wanted to come home from whatever kind of life they've been living, we would, every one of us, be willing to drive anywhere and pick them up. And we wouldn't worry about the time of night. We wouldn't worry about what it costs to get there and pick them up. And it is that kind of an attitude that we must have in our dealings with each other as well. Unbroken commitment, undying love, and unlimited forgiveness.